Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 16th, 2022. And the first order of business is to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Yeah.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Backlund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damon.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grünhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Pryor, present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. And Representative Morrison, motion to approve the minutes.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So Representative Morrison is moving approval of the minutes of March 15th, yesterday, for approval. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes of March 15th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And thank you, members. And I think that I may have a slightly unstable connection. I just need to tell you all, I am back in the office building today. And so the technology is doing a little bit of weird stuff. So if it seems not quite smooth, that might be the reason. So we'll do our best here. Anyway, the first bill that we have today is House File 3886, which is Representative Morrison's bill. And so the motion here would be Representative Morrison's motion that House File 3886, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there's also an author's amendment. Representative Morrison, did you want to move that first and get the bill in the shape you want it?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A2 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Morrison's moving the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails and the A2 is adopted. Okay, so the bill is before us as amended, House File 3886. Representative Morrison, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, would you like me to discuss just 3886 and 3887 together, or would you prefer I do them separately?
So, Representative Morrison, I think what we could do, we have to do them one at a time. It becomes really confusing if we try to combine them, but I understand they're very related and that the testifiers really want to speak to both. So why don't you tell us about 3886 and then we'll try to stick to that. And when we get to 3887, you can just refer back to the other piece if that's okay. It's hard. I don't know. We'll see how it goes because I know they're kind
certainly
of
combined. Certainly, Madam Chair. They are very similar, so I could be very brief on the second round. So, Madam Chair, members, the A2 amendment simply expands the kinds of providers that can participate in the program. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3886, which is a universal voluntary home visiting program. The bill specifically calls for home visiting services that provide a range of 1 to 6 visits that occur prenatally or with the first 4 months of the expected birth or adoption of an infant. And works to improve the outcomes in 2 or more areas, including maternal and newborn health, school readiness, family economic self-sufficiency, coordination and referral for other community resources and supports, reduction in child injuries, abuse, or neglect, or reduction in crime or domestic violence. The bill asks the Commissioner of Health to ensure that these voluntary home visiting services are available to all families residing in Minnesota by June 30th, 2025, prioritizing areas of high need with grants until the program is available statewide. As you will hear from our testifiers, family home visiting is a proven strategy to improve pregnancy and birth outcomes, address maternal and infant health needs, support development of secure attachment with children, address breastfeeding and feeding questions and concerns, and connect families to community resources to address the unique needs of each family. Many of you are aware of the benefits of targeted family home visiting programs, but may not know that short-term programs also have compelling benefits to families, including improved child health and development, increased parent-child attachment, and increased rates of kindergarten readiness. Improved maternal outcomes, such as decreases in maternal depression, increases in maternal employment, and reductions in alcohol and drug use. There are also decreases in child abuse and maltreatment and an increased understanding of positive child development. Most families have been impacted by the pandemic. We know there are increased mental health needs of parents and children. We've seen increases in maternal death rates and increased developmental delays for babies and young children. We also know some families have been impacted through the loss of loved ones, the loss of employment, the loss of housing, or experiencing challenges accessing healthy food. Minnesota has made important investments in voluntary home visiting programs for pregnancy, for pregnant women and families with young children. I believe it's critical to provide all infants and their families access to resources early to connect them to the resources in their community that will help their family thrive. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers to provide more in-depth and real-world information about how home visiting services work and the impact they have on families. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. And okay, our first testifier on the list is Cynthia Fodrick. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Fodrick. I'm a public health nurse representing St. Paul, Ramsey County Public Health, and the Minnesota Coalition for Family Home Visiting. And the coalition represents a broad array of nonprofit organizations, local public health agencies, tribal health agencies, early Head Start home visiting, as well as local education home visiting programs. As family home visitors, we work to assist families through voluntary home visiting services, which can begin during pregnancy or after birth and continue based on families' needs for up to 2 years. The families we serve have many lived experiences, and we acknowledge the strengths, wisdom, and diversity of the communities we serve. Many of the families served by targeted family home visiting programs are faced with systemic inequities. Some live in poverty, experience mental health challenges, experience housing and food instability, experience chemical addiction, or come from the foster care system. We know that COVID-19 has created challenges for every family in Minnesota. It has had a disproportionate impact on families with young children and has exacerbated the health disparities that exist in Black, American Indian, and other underrepresented diverse communities. We believe offering voluntary family home visits to every child born and adopted over the next few years here in Minnesota can help stabilize families as they work to rebuild the pandemic. And through reducing stigma or concerns that families might have in accessing supports and identifying families that might traditionally fall under the radar, our home visiting programs make a positive impact in the lives of the families we serve. Our goals are really to empower mothers, fathers, and families to support their child's cognitive, physical, and social-emotional development, improve health outcomes, and work towards self-sufficiency through education and employment, thus improving family well-being, as well as contributing to the overall well-being of the community. And so we really hope that you will support House File 3886 and House File 3887 and provide every Minnesota infant and family access to voluntary family home visiting after birth or adoption. And these really serve to give our families the necessary boost and to give them a strong, stable, and healthy start in life. Thank you very much. And I am happy to respond to any questions that you have regarding the bill.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Carrie Sawyer. Welcome.
Thank you. Yep. My name is Kari Sawyer, and I'm a licensed parent and family educator with 13 years of experience working with children and families, most of them within early childhood home visiting. And for the past 7 years, overseeing an ECFE home visiting program in the metro area that's averaged over 1,000 home visits per school year. I'm here specifically to speak on the value and history of ECFE as a universal access home visiting service. Being able to provide voluntary in-home parenting support provides such a huge benefit to families. Parents who've received ECFE home visits have shared these benefits, including one that said, as a busy mom, these home visits help both me and my child understand how to deal with temperament and development. Another parent shared that being a first-time mom and being young, I didn't really have a set routine, and Wednesday visits with our home visitor were the one thing I could always look forward to. Families receive parenting support, connection to resources, and a link to their school district through ECFE home visiting. The home visiting aspect of ECFE began receiving funding in 1992. However, home visiting has been implemented by ECFE programs since the pilot began in the mid-1970s. Per Minnesota state statute, ECFE home visiting is intended to reach isolated or at-risk families as a priority. Our home visiting programs incorporate evidence-informed parenting education practices and are facilitated by qualified and trained ECFE staff. Clear objectives and protocols are established for visits. Families are encouraged to make a transition from home visits to site-based parenting programs. ECFE home visits provide program services that are community-based, accessible, culturally and linguistically relevant, and foster collaboration among existing agencies and community-based organizations that serve families with young children. These collaborations include partnerships with early childhood special education, early childhood screening, hospitals and clinics, MVNA, community centers, libraries, childcare centers, and many more. ECFE is a logical partner for Universal Home Visiting in Minnesota, and we support HF 3886 and HF 3887 because it helps every child and family get a strong start. So thank you for your time and your support for Universal Home Visiting.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Sawyer. So those are the two testifiers that I had listed for the bill. I think we can go now to member questions and discussion. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a huge thank you to Representative Morrison for bringing this bill. I think this is fantastic. We know the value that this program brings and that these home visits bring and how important these investments are for, you know, families' lives and kiddos into the future. So thank you. My question is, how do families get this information and how do they opt in? How do they know that this is an option for them? Is that at doctor's appointments or what does that look like?
Representative Morrison?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bolden. The idea is that it will become sort of baked into the culture, and certainly the visit at the pediatrician's office for a well-child visit at ECFE and schools. But I should defer to one of the testifiers who have on-ground experience with this now to tell us about how it works now.
I don't know which one would be the one to answer that question. Ms. Andre?
Madam Chair, I can answer this question.
Please.
So yes, currently how we get our referrals are we do community engagement. So a lot of our programs are through programs such as WIC, also hospitals, clinics. We do community outreach with like the YMCA and other partners that are really servicing families that feel that can be a good fit for a home family home visiting. So I suspect that with this particular bill, if we go towards universal home visiting, it will go to the point of like reaching out to even our educator sites, you know, so schools, preschools, childcare centers, clinics, hospitals, because, and then our doula organizations and the different providers that would be able to provide universal home visiting. Thank you.
Representative Bolden, follow up? Okay, that's great. And I have a couple of questions too. And first of all, I just want to say that I also think this is so compelling and so important. And just yesterday in Representative Schultz's committee, I think, we were hearing a bill about kids in foster care, and one of the testifiers talked about how he used to chew on his shirt as a young child because he was so hungry, and it wasn't discovered that he was in distress until he went to school. And I was thinking about this very thing, about home visiting and the ability to have eyes on kids and to be able to spot this kind of extreme distress so much earlier, and you know how this child suffered for quite longer than he really should have had to because of this. And anyway, it's a very, very important program. But the question I have is, with this big expansion of the program, you know, we're having trouble with workforce all over the place. And I'm just wondering about the kinds of backgrounds that people would have. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just, you know, where do you see pulling the workforce from to expand the program to be able to really cover many, many more families? And I know we're not covering, you know, we're so far from everybody, but where will we look for the workforce to be able to do this? What kind of training do people need to be able to do effective home visiting?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and great question, and one that applies to every sector of every industry right now. But the bill does explicitly name a group of different health professionals who can be involved in this. And we've explicitly left it open. The amendment actually leaves it a little more open so that there, in the future, more can be brought in. But we explicitly name doulas, community health workers, perinatal health educators, early childhood family education, home visiting providers, public health nurses, and the amendment adds more today. But I could certainly defer to one of our experts in home visiting to further flesh that out. I believe that we have Laura LaCroix-Deline on. She may be able to flesh out your question more, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Ms. LaCroix-Deline, please introduce yourself and see if you can address the question. Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, Laura LaCroix-Deline with the Minnesota Coalition for Family Home Visiting. The intent for offering the Minnesota Baby Steps in House File 3887 and Universal Home Visiting in House File 3886 is to really build upon the existing professionals and paraprofessionals that are doing this work. So you will see, which is a new addition to bring together the healthcare workforce, the local public health workforce, tribal health, nonprofits, ECFE through their home visiting program. So we really do need to harness those who are doing this work. And we believe this is a great way to not only boost families as they get started and rebuild from the pandemic, but it really brings the workforce that is doing this in different sectors together in an important way, coordinated way.
Great. Thank you very much for that answer. I appreciate it. And it just makes me think it really does take a village, doesn't it? And this is really critical work. Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Morrison. I know we've served together on early childhood before, and I have carried bills for voluntary home visiting programs. And I just wanted to say that what's really remarkable about these programs is that we have so much science, so much information that shows the incredible amount of development that these little ones are experiencing at such an early age. And we have the ability to literally get ahead of this, to help those little minds grow and flourish, to help parents to be strong and stable for their kiddos, because who doesn't want that for their children, and really get them off to a great start. You know, we talk about how we close achievement gaps and how we handle those situations. Here's an opportunity where we can actually close the door on those gaps before they get started. So it's a really tremendous program, and I really encourage members to support it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Okay, final word on this one, Representative Morrison, and then we'll go to the second one.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members, I hope you'll join me in supporting voluntary home visiting so that Minnesota's families get off to the best possible start and have the information and access to resources they need to thrive. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. So House File 3886, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And then Representative Morrison is going to move that House File 3887, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I assume you want to move the A2 author's amendment on that one. So
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the identical A2 amendment on House File 3887 as well.
All right. So that has been moved. So let's adopt the A2 amendment and then we'll talk about the bill. So all in favor of adopting the A2 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These bills are essentially identical, except that House File 3886 is a universal voluntary home visiting program that has ongoing funding. And House File 3887 that is before us now is the Minnesota Baby Steps Home Visiting Program, which is a self-limited program that is designed really with the pandemic in mind to address the immediate need, but it is a self-limited one-time funding.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions or discussion to House File 3887? All right, not seeing any. So very good, and thanks for that good explanation. So House File 3887, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And thank you, Representative Morrison. Thank you very much to the testifiers.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 4025. Representative Richardson, welcome to the committee.
And, thank you, Madam Chair.
And since Representative Richardson's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 4025 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And thank you very much for bringing this here, Representative Richardson. And the floor is yours. Please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4025 expands the Healthcare Bill of Rights and statute and establishes a right for a pregnant patient to have a designated support person present while receiving healthcare. The issue of laboring alone in hospitals and the increased risks that arise has gained national attention, and onechange.org petition on the subject has garnered more than 613,000 signatures to support the right for pregnant patients to have a designated support person while receiving care. In addition, this is one of the community recommendations from the House Select Committee on Racial Justice Report, and it's also the stance of the World Health Organization. During the pandemic, restrictions have resulted in pregnant patients giving birth alone or effectively banning doulas. Decisions to separate families during and after childbirth is harmful, and it can have long-lasting implications. It has impacts on mental health and also endangers the physical health of patients as well. A spouse, partner, or another family member in the birthing room can help the patient assert their wishes, run interference, and we all know that giving birth is a very, very vulnerable state to be in, and no one should have to do that alone. A recent study evaluating more than 15,000 patients that gave birth speaks to the numerous health benefits of having a support person during labor, including a decreased need for pain medication, which reduces the side effects associated, higher satisfaction with birth, shorter labors, fewer C-sections, and that is notable because the risk of death after a C-section is 5 times higher than a vaginal birth. Higher Epworth scores among babies, and those scores relate to examining categories for things like breathing and respiration and heart rates, and fewer instrumental deliveries and lower risk of complications that can result from the use of those. Furthermore, the data on childbirth in the United States is terrifying. I've testified in committee on the fact that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth. And what's heartbreaking is that the vast majority of those deaths are preventable. And the ability to have someone who can speak up for a patient in crisis can be the difference between life and death. Furthermore, 1 in 3 women report that their births were traumatic. Some of the more disturbing data: 28% of women who give birth in hospitals report being mistreated, things such as being shouted at, threatened, physically restrained, or being forced into medical interventions that they have declined. 33% of birth workers say that they've heard a healthcare provider use racist language in the delivery room. 55% of birth workers report seeing a doctor or other care provider perform a medical procedure even after a patient has said no. Also, it's important to note that this bill would ensure that parent patients will not be put in the position of having to choose between a spouse or a doula or a midwife. We want to be clear that doulas, midwives, and partners play very different roles and are not substitutes for each other. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to yield my time to my testifier.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Richardson. And as you tell that story, as you talk about that, I'm sure every one of us, even, you know, even those of us who are not giving birth and, you know, just whenever you go to the hospital, the idea of being isolated and unable to access a person who would be there to support you is really a terrifying thought. So thank you. Welcome to the committee. And I'm going to let you pronounce your own name because I'm afraid I'm going to mangle it, but welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Akmeri Sakara. I work for the Cultural Wellness Center, and I have been a birth worker slash doula for the last 30 years here in the Twin Cities. And so I would like to say that the midwife, OB-GYN, physician, and nurse must focus on facilitating a healthy birth. The doula's main concern is to promote the mother's comfort, well-being, and parental readiness. And so we are like the best teachers, therapists, and parents. The doula ultimately is a person with social and emotional intelligence and maturity, empathy, compassion, and warmth, who is personally and self-aware and open to being needed by a person who's in an extremely vulnerable situation. And I've been at many births over the years where I know that the support that I have given to my family has been well needed. And especially during these COVID times, it's been very difficult to be able to be allowed in the birth room without having to be vaccinated or et cetera, et cetera. And so people need support, and we're a consistent support that goes long-term. Even with the changing of the guard in the hospital rooms, we're still there through the whole process until we see a baby. And so I think that it's extremely important to be able to have this other kind of set of people who know what's really going on in a room, be able to be present. So we provide answers to questions as often as needed. You're a nurturer and a protector, and we advocate for the mother and the partner's needs with medical and hospital officials. So I really believe that what we bring is much needed in the room. So we're just another eye and ear that is really thinking about the family that is going through a transformational time. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Member discussion. Questions? Yes, Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. The work that we did together on the Select Committee on Racial Justice did highlight the disparaging outcomes for Black women specifically. And I think this bill is an effort to improve that. You know, if we can have that support person, but not have those numbers counted against us, you know, if we do use a doula, I just think that's very important. One question, Representative Richardson, if I could direct that to you, is have you thought of expanding it beyond just in labor and delivery or in pregnancy?
The reason for my question is I have aging parents, and this is something that I've just in the last few months realized the importance of having someone with for those appointments too, specifically a second maybe person that can filter through with both parents being aging. So Madam Chair, if I could direct that to Representative Richardson.
Okay, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Damuth, for the question, and enjoyed working with you on the House Select Committee on Racial Justice as well. And yes, I have I have thought about that as well. You know, bringing this bill forward is really a reflection of the work that was done within the House Select Committee on racial justice, and it's also just really something that has gained a lot of national attention as well. But it is a need that when you're thinking about people in some of the most vulnerable spaces and places, to be able to have someone there as a support is very valuable, and very open to having more conversations about that, but also wanted to be able to lift up the work of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice as well.
Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for explaining that. I look forward to continued work, and again, thanks for bringing this forward. I think it's going to help a number of people. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really just a comment. I want to thank Representative Richardson for all of the work that she continues to do to address our unacceptable racial disparities in maternal and infant outcomes. I think that this is a really important step. There's not going to be one thing that is going to solve this challenge, but this is absolutely a piece of the puzzle. And she did such an excellent job of enumerating all of the evidence that exists of how important this is in terms of impacting outcomes. As an obstetrician myself, I have witnessed scenarios where people are only allowed to have one person, where they have to choose between a partner or a doula when they're being wheeled into a C-section. And most people feel frightened in that scenario. But if you are already in a place where you feel like you're in a hostile environment and you're not feeling supported and you're feeling frightened, to limit the amount of support that people can have is nonsensical. So just a big thank you to Representative Richardson for bringing this forward. I'm excited to support it.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. Other discussion questions? All right, not seeing any. And I also think this is really compelling, and it resonates for me back to, I think, previous work that Representative Richardson did, and the idea that Black women in particular are not listened to or not heard when they express their needs. And it, of course, as you said, Representative Richardson, when you're pregnant, when you're delivering, you're in a very vulnerable situation. And to have somebody there who is your support person to help amplify your requests and to say, no, she really means it hurts, you know, or whatever it might be, is I can only imagine that it could be a very critical and make a real difference in the care somebody receives. So I think this is a very important bill. So with that, House File 4025 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And thank you very much. And thank you to the testifier as well. The next bill on the agenda is another Morrison bill, House File 3153. And this one was heard in preventive health. So we have a division report on House File 3153 from the Preventive Health Policy Division. And Chair Freiberg, do you want to move adoption of that report? Okay, so Representative Freiberg moves. Excellent, thank you.
Sorry,
so moved. So first vote is, very good, thanks. The first vote is just to vote to adopt the report so we can take up the bill. And so this is just a voice vote. All in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the report is adopted. And then Representative Morrison's motion would be that House File 3153 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there's also an A1 author's amendment. So Representative Morrison, did you want to, are those your motions you want to make right now?
Madam Chair, those are my motions.
Okay, so the motion before us is adopting the amendment. All in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted and the bill as amended is before us. And Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment contains language recommended by DHS. It does not impact the intent or the goal of the bill to remove barriers to tobacco treatment. It brings the language in line with other contracting practices. It establishes some safety guardrails around quantity limits. So House File 3153 would make sure that Minnesotans on Medicaid and MinnesotaCare can access the tobacco cessation medications and treatment they need. Almost all of us know someone that has been addicted to tobacco and struggled to quit. Tobacco addiction is a chronic relapsing condition that often requires multiple attempts to quit and repeated individualized treatment. All Minnesotans pay the price for tobacco's harm. Smoking, taking the lives of more than 6,300 Minnesotans each year, those deaths are preventable. Smoking costs the state $7 billion a year. And in Minnesota's medical assistance program alone, smoking-related health care costs $563 million annually. Luckily, there's something we can do about it. A study done by the American Lung Association and Penn State University found a 26% return on investment for states that invest in tobacco cessation treatment. Tobacco cessation help costs a fraction what it takes to annually treat tobacco-related diseases such as lung cancer and cardiovascular disease. Minnesotans enrolled in medical assistance in MinnesotaCare face barriers to tobacco cessation treatment, and coverage can change from year to year, creating confusion for providers and patients. People respond differently to different interventions, so coverage for a range of counseling types and medications is essential. Our public programs do currently cover some FDA-approved medications and individual and group counseling without cost sharing. This bill would build on what our state does by ensuring all enrollees have a comprehensive cessation benefit and can access all medications and counseling without quantity limits and prior authorization. There is overwhelming evidence that access is a significant barrier for Medicaid enrollees. This bill would also allow more providers trained in tobacco treatment counseling to be reimbursed. Added providers include mental health specialists and alcohol and drug counselors, ensuring that patients can see their trusted provider for tobacco treatment. This will not only support our healthcare workers, but improve patient access to trained tobacco treatment counseling. There's overwhelming evidence that access is a significant barrier. This bill would allow for the use of telehealth for tobacco treatment counseling when appropriate. It's all about supporting Minnesotans who want to quit tobacco, ensuring they face as few barriers as possible to quitting a highly addictive product, and supporting our providers by making sure they're reimbursed for providing tobacco counseling. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And so we have two testifiers. And as I said, this bill did come from Preventive Health, so we don't need to spend a lot of time, but we're grateful to have Emily Myatt here. Welcome.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Emily Myatt. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I'm one of the chairs of Minnesotans for Smoke-Free Generation. For people who use commercial tobacco products, having access to things like counseling and tobacco cessation medications can double the chances of quitting successfully. Research shows that Medicaid enrollees are more likely to quit if their Medicaid coverage does not impose any barriers to care. This bill would remove barriers like prior authorization and quantity limits, ensuring patients can access all of the medications and counseling they may need. This bill is also about health equity. Medicaid serves communities that continue to use commercial tobacco at higher rates, including people with limited incomes, folks in greater Minnesota, and individuals living with mental health or substance use disorders. And we know that the tobacco industry has targeted these populations. Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation is proud to partner with the Long Mind Alliance on this bill, whose goal is to reduce the impact of commercial tobacco on people with mental illness and substance use disorders. Committee members received a letter of support from many behavioral health partners, including the American Lung Association, MARCH, and NAMI. This common sense bill would ensure Medicaid and Minnesota care enrollees can access the medications and counseling they need to quit, and that they can see their trusted provider in the setting that works for them. We want to thank Representative Morrison for her leadership on this issue. We look forward to continuing to work with bill authors and DHS to ensure the language matches our shared goals. Thanks for considering this important policy.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And we have Katie O'Brien. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie O'Brien, and I'm a registered nurse and vice president of operations at People Incorporated. People Incorporated supports mental health and wellness in our community through collaboration and integration of care. As a provider of community-based mental health and substance use services, we are committed to helping our clients improve their overall health and have been providing comprehensive tobacco treatment since 2018. Individuals living with mental illness and substance use disorders are more dependent on tobacco, smoke more heavily, and are more likely to die from tobacco-related illness than from their mental health or substance use condition. We can do better. Mental health and substance use disorder professionals have the skills and, as importantly, the relationships to effectively provide tobacco education and counseling in the context of delivering other behavioral health services in the whole person approach to treatment. Unfortunately, our current system prohibits many of these provider types from being allowed to bill for reimbursement for these services, and all of these services are within their scope of practice. This is reminiscent of the days when tobacco use was only seen as a primary healthcare matter. Now that we know better, we can do better. Research has shown that receiving tobacco treatment concurrent with mental health and substance use treatment results in better mental health, less depression, less anxiety, less stress, an increased sense of well-being, and results in a 25% increased change of long-term sobriety. Our own providers and patients see these benefits. Naturally, adding more provider types that can be reimbursed will increase access and sustainability by expanding services in rural Minnesota and among disparity populations. And by removing barriers to medications and counseling, we can ensure more Minnesota patients can get the care they need. Tobacco dependence should be addressed as part of recovery-based mental health and substance use treatment. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. O'Brien. Appreciate your testimony. So with that, we can go to member discussion questions. Okay, I'm being told by my computer that my connection's unstable, so I hope I didn't miss anybody, but I'm not seeing any questions. Okay, and I know that Ms. Abderholden is also here for questions, if there are any. And okay, well, very good. I appreciate especially that we are really addressing that connection between tobacco addiction and mental health issues. And That just seems to be a no-brainer, that people who already counsel on issues of addiction or issues of behavioral health should include tobacco cessation. So thank you very much for your testimony today. And with that, House File 3153, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you very much to our Representative Morrison and our testifiers. Now we will go to Representative Jordan. We have House File 3873, and the chair will move that House File 3873 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. And Representative Jordan, welcome, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. It's always good to be in this committee. I will probably not shock any of you when I say I am once again here to talk about lead and solutions to minimize Minnesotans' contact with it. I hope you all remember that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. House File 3873 is an agency bill I have worked on with the Department of Health to make needed updates to our policy around lead hazard reduction and renovations. The Department of Health is responsible for regulating abatement and reduction of lead-based paint hazards since 1989 in residential structures, schools, and child-occupied facilities. In 2009, MDH revised the lead poisoning prevention statute to develop rules consistent with the federal Renovate, Repair, and Paint, or RRP rule. This bill makes a number of policy changes that were discovered in the course of developing MDH's RRP rule. And please stop me if I use too many acronyms. The first change addresses differences between the lead abatement and RRP rule thresholds. Currently, we are not in compliance with federal standards here, and this change will alleviate confusion among certified lead firms submitting lead hazard reduction notifications to the department. The second part of the proposal addresses the primary intent issue with regard to lead hazard reduction and renovation work in residences and child-occupied facilities. To accomplish this, we move back to the original lead law language, which was from pre-2009 regarding primary intent, and place it under the revised definition of lead hazard reduction. And the third part of the proposal revises the definition of a certified renovation firm so that it is aligned with the federal RRP standard. I have with me today Dan Loker, the asbestos and lead compliance supervisor at MDH, to answer technical questions that members may have about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. And that was all pretty quick. So members, any questions, any discussion? All right, not seeing any. So, all right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Jordan. You are our lead elimination member for sure, leading the lead elimination caucus. There isn't really such caucus, but you're probably, we're all in it one way or another, I guess.
Madam Chair, you're all invited to join my caucus.
All right. Getting rid of lead. Because there is no safe level, as you have said.
Good.
Okay. So House File 3873 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. So thank you again. And thank you for the people here ready to answer the questions. Appreciate it. Okay. And now we have, and this is our final bill on the agenda for today. So we are moving right along. And we don't, Representative Keeler can talk as slowly if she so chooses. House File 3599, Representative Keeler, welcome to the committee. There she is. And so she's not on our committee. So the chair will move that House File 3599, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is an author's amendment, the A4 amendment. And Representative Keeler, did you want us to just adopt that and then you'll explain it with the amendment? Or would you, what is your pleasure with regard to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can just briefly explain what the amendment is and where it came from, if that's helpful.
Sure. Okay. So I will move the A4 amendment. So it is before us. And then please go ahead and tell us about the A4 amendment.
Sure. So thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3599 has made a couple stops prior to being here, and things have come to our attention. And so this adjustment is actually in Section 1. The first line is not needed just because of the way the statute is, but we did keep that the commissioner must prioritize providing trauma-informed, culturally inclusive services, because in the realm of work that this is, we felt that that was still important. To keep, because that language is not word for word in the statute that we're looking at.
Okay, very good. Any questions about the amendment? All right, not seeing any. So all in favor of adoption of the A4 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, and go ahead then, Representative Keeler, the floor is yours and please explain the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What this bill does is it actually provides support for trauma-informed services around human trafficking. In a lot of the spaces that I've been in, and I think many of you have been in, this is a topic that we keep talking about, and it's it's showing up in our education conversations, in our healthcare conversations, in our health services conversations, in our human services conversations, in our preventing homelessness conversations. It's everywhere. One of the first things that really hit home for me is I'm a mom. Many of us have kids in our life. The MCA started asking our 9th and 11th graders questions around sex trafficking. And what we know is that 1.7% of our youth in this state answered yes, that they are involved in some capacity of sex trafficking, whether it's for food, whether it's for shelter, whether it's for money or other needs. What we also know is that 40% of sex trafficking cases involve a minor. The average age of that minor is 13 years old. So I just want you all to sit, like, whatever kids you have in your life, that is terrifying as a human, as a mom, as somebody who like absolutely cares about kids, not only in my own community, but across the state. So what this bill does is it creates and extends the funding that we have around our Safe Harbor Acts. There's a couple components to it. Because of the Safe Harbor Act and the areas that it supports, there's two different agencies that are involved. We've already gone through human services and talked about that. Here we'll talk about the Department of Health and what they do with their funding, and then also talk about the navigators and what they do and what the increase in funding in that space would be benefited for. When I talked to the MDH this morning about what some of the areas are, specifically it's coordinated services, tribal national grant or tribal nations grants, and different outreach and supports that we use all over the state. About the navigators, the one piece that I found really interesting is we have 9 navigators across our state. And as a Greater Minnesota member, I drive 3.5 hours one way just to get here for work. And we're sending our navigators out to drive hours on the road to be able to provide supports. And so what this would do is it would increase the opportunity to add more navigators so they can be more effective in doing the work rather than just driving everywhere. But also it would help them be in a space with livable wages because they are doing an extraordinary job. I mean, we want to make sure that we continue to keep them in those roles because we know high stress jobs have high turnover and this work is extremely important in our communities. I'm gonna yield the rest of my time to my testifiers and leave this open for any conversation that we have at this point, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Keeler. Okay, I think I'm having a little problem with having unstable internet, so I hope that you can hear me and that it all makes sense. But anyway, so we have some testifiers and the first that I have on my list is Beth Holger. And welcome to the committee. And if you would just state your name and who you're with and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee for taking the time to hear House File 3599 today. And also, I want to sincerely thank our chief author, Representative Keeler, for her work and passionate leadership on this bill. My name is Beth Holger, and I'm the CEO of The Link. We are a youth and adult-led nonprofit based here in North Minneapolis that provides supportive services, emergency shelter, and housing for youth who have been victims, survivors of sex trafficking, or who are experiencing homelessness, or who have been involved with the juvenile justice or child welfare systems. We are currently the host site and have been since the Safe Harbor Law passed for the West Metro Regional Navigator and Safe Harbor Supportive Services Shelter and Housing. I'm also here as one of the policy committee co-chairs for the Youth Services Network, which is a statewide coalition of youth serving agencies. It goes without saying that Minnesota's children and youth should never be bought and sold for someone else's profit, for sex or sexual assault. But it's happening here every day in every part of our state, whether it's urban, rural, suburban, or tribal communities. The average age, as Representative said, is 13. We see youth as young as 11 and 12 at The Link. We have youth that young in our emergency shelter as we speak right now who have been victims of sex trafficking, and it's truly heartbreaking. On behalf of the Youth Services Network, we are asking for one-time funds for a prevalence study. Although it is wonderful to have the data from the Minnesota Student Survey, it does not include those young people that aren't in school on that day, as sometimes traffickers don't, you know, allow young people to attend school regularly. And it also doesn't include young people that may not be comfortable asking a government, you know, answering that question on any kind of survey. So we are asking for a prevalence study to determine the number of youth and adult trafficking victims in our state, as well as an additional $20 million to expand out the specialized services, regional navigators, and emergency shelter and housing options for these young people, because we just need more for them. We know this is a good investment because it literally saves and changes young people's lives, but it also is a wise financial investment. In 2012, the University of Minnesota did a cost-benefit analysis study and found that for every $1 of government-invested funds into providing support for trafficking victims, it yields a $34 return on investment. We also know that it's the right thing to do because it works. An evaluation done between 2017 and 2019 by the Wilder Research Center that found that there was a total of 1,279 youth served by Safe Harbor funded grantees across the state. So the link is one of many, many grantees. And 97% of these youth self-reported positive changes in their life after receiving Safe Harbor services that can include things, outcomes around education, increasing employment, and well-being. I know that this works too because I get the opportunity to see it firsthand every day and night. The link, along with many of our agencies, never close. And the young people continue to amaze me, inspire me, and continue to teach me so much, no matter how long you're in this work. And so I'm just asking to please use some of the surplus to invest in their safety and in their futures. Thank you so much for the time today.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Holly Henning, welcome.
Bonjour, Anine, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Holly Henning, and I'm an enrolled tribal member of Martin Falls Anishinaabe First Nation. And I'm also the Deputy Associate Director at Ainda Young Center. I'm here today in support of the Safe Harbor funding that's outlined in House File 3599. Ainda Young Center is located here in St. Paul, and it means our home in the Ojibwe language. We're a nonprofit serving homeless and at-risk American Indian youth and families in the Twin Cities. And we specifically serve youth who have histories of sexual exploitation and human trafficking. Ainda Young Center currently receives around $300,000 in Safe Harbor funding to serve youth in the Native community. As a survivor of sexual exploitation and lived experience with homelessness, I am honored to be able to work with this population. I believe that no Minnesotan is for sale, and our youth are priceless, and we need to continue to uplift our next generations. Safe Harbor specializes in supportive services, shelter, housing for survivors, to heal from trauma of sex trafficking, exploitation, and survival sex. I ask that you would support this request, which is an increase of $20 million, $9 million for sustaining and expanding street outreach, emergency shelter and housing, $2 million for sustaining and expanding Safe Harbor regional navigators, and $9 million for Safe Harbor supportive services. And our agencies will continue to provide survivors with safety and trauma-informed care that meets each one of their unique needs, prevent further victimization, create healing and mental health, substance abuse counseling and other wellness, and to create opportunities for employment and education success. Chimi Gwech, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to help answer any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And we have Caitlin Orgon, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Orgon. I'm an assistant program director at a nonprofit called Evergreen Youth and Family Services up in Bemidji. Evergreen currently has two different sites. We have a shelter that serves minors ages 9 through 17. And that shelter does have a certification to serve Safe Harbor youth. We also run a drop-in center that houses many different programs, including street outreach and Safe Harbor housing. I'm incredibly grateful to be speaking with you today to give a representation of the northern part of the state. Beltrami County has one of the highest rates of poverty and the highest rate of children being removed from the home in the state. We know that poverty and involvement with the foster care system are major risk factors for youth to be targeted by exploiters. We've mentioned a little bit previously the Minnesota Students Survey. Youth in Northwestern Minnesota self-disclose sexual exploitation more than any other region in the state. Since 2018, Evergreen Youth and Family Services has housed 26 youth survivors of sexual exploitation and provided services for an additional 38 clients. We typically receive over 30 referrals a year, but we currently have funding to house only 4 youth at any given time. American Indians make up about 20% of Beltrami County's population. However, about 55% of our Safe Harbor clients at Evergreen identify as American Indian, which is a gross overrepresentation of Indigenous youth requesting Safe Harbor services. We cannot talk about sex trafficking and exploitation without recognizing the historical trauma and systems of oppression that our nation's first people have endured. In the past year at Evergreen, we've housed 2 17-year-olds. These youth had been sexually exploited. They did not have any support from their families, and county social services were not willing to intervene. I would have never believed this scenario would happen to any youth in Minnesota until I saw it happen multiple times and continue to see it happen. The truth of the matter is that many youth who have been sexually exploited in Minnesota do not simply fall through the cracks. They are pushed through the cracks, which is unacceptable. So why do we need increased investments for youth that have been exploited? The answer is very simple. It's our responsibility to protect the most vulnerable members of our communities. The state of Minnesota has truly led the way across the country in creating legislation and services for sexually exploited youth, but we have a long way to go. Our youth are resilient and passionate. They want to heal. They want to continue their education. Many of them want to go into helping professions, and they're strong advocates for vulnerable members of our society. And we owe them every opportunity to thrive. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. So I think that's all the testifiers we have on the bill. So we can go to member questions or discussion. Members, are there any questions? So I will start off with a question, and I don't know if this would be for Representative Keeler or if maybe Ms. Holger. I hope I'm saying your name right, but Ms. Holger was the person who talked about the study part of the bill, the prevalence study. And I'm just wondering, as I think about that, I'm having trouble picturing how you would study the prevalence of sex trafficking in Minnesota. Do you have any, can either of you shed any light on what that study would look like?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am gonna pass it over to my testifier.
All right, thank you, Representative Keeler. Ms. Holger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keeler. That is an excellent question. And we are very fortunate to have some very experienced researchers on the topic within the University of Minnesota, for example, and what they have talked about doing potentially if awarded the funds. And I know that there would have to be an RFP, but I'm just using them as an example, is that they would have to do a basically an estimate based on the number of young people found. So what they would do is an extrapolation or an estimate, similar to what we do when we count, for example, the number of young people experiencing homelessness. For every one young person that's found, we would estimate that X number are out there also experiencing homelessness. Because to your point, it is absolutely correct that we would never be able to interview every single trafficked youth or find every single one in the state. So there would be a conservative estimate that's done by academic researchers to determine that. And that's what we're missing in our state. We get asked every day what the numbers are. And I can tell you the numbers we serve at the link. We can tell you the numbers that are found during law enforcement operations, but unfortunately we don't have a good statewide prevalence estimate. Thank you, that was a great question.
Okay, well, thank you for the answer. And I see we have a question from Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this bill forward. And I'm also glad that it's at a time in our committee where we can actually spend some time talking about this issue and how you've come forward with another piece of the puzzle for what we can do to help, you know, this population that we're talking about. And as we said, the most vulnerable and, you know, this crime that's being committed against them is, we know, unacceptable, and one of those issues that all of us are agreed on. And the question that I guess at this point, if I can ask, that, you know, there's a sense that we're not serving, that we're missing the children, the youth that are being pushed into the cracks, out of sight. What are you seeing right now? If I can ask the people that are on the ground, what are you seeing now that would be evidence of the youths that we're not reaching and are not being helped right now? Are people being turned out that should be staying in a safe harbor situation and a protected situation, having to leave early, not knowing what happens to them? Or are you having contacts where you know that someone you would want to bring somebody in and help them, but just don't have the capacity at this point to do it? So could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Okay, let's see. I don't know who to call on for that. I think it's directed either to Ms. Henning or to Ms. Argon, I think. One of the providers, people that are working directly in the field. So Ms. Argon?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I can say that we absolutely don't have the funding to house everyone that is eligible for those services. Like I said, we typically have over 30 referrals a year for the program, and we have the budget to house four. So I'm also seeing that there's a lack of understanding from social services across the state. It's not just one jurisdiction in particular, understanding the dynamics of exploitation and trafficking and what the response should be.
Representative Pryor? Okay, that's good. Okay, thank you. Other questions or discussion? All right, not seeing any. So thank you very much, Representative Keeler and testifiers. And so with that, House File 3599 as amended is laid over, at first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you again and appreciate all the testifiers being here, and thank you very much for your work as well. Okay, members, that brings us to the end of our agenda for today. We've ended a little bit early. We are meeting on Friday, the 18th, and we do have quite a full agenda. And so we'll see you at 10:30 on Friday. And with that, we stand adjourned.